That's a big undertaking.
Obviously, Dan sent me his resume.
You should tell him you remember reading the Pentagon Papers, and I, real time, then he'll really know how old you are.
Ask him if he remembers Neville Chamberlain.
Bush said you're allowed to read the Pentagon Papers.
Yeah, Bush?
Yeah.
What does Bush have to do with it?
Well, he says you're allowed to do all kinds of spying.
That I don't know.
Stop.
It's all legal.
No, let's not get into politics, guys.
Barry, we hear congratulations are in order?
Yes, we are very...
Mazel tov to the colors.
Who is right?
You have another female in the family.
Mm-hmm. Right. I was saying that we have two grandsons and two granddaughters, which is very important because one of our sons-in-law is a computational geneticist. So if you didn't get it exactly right, I think we'd be in trouble.
Computational geneticist.
Oh, boy.
Yes,
maybe
it's a girl.
Yes,
it's a girl.
Yes,
it's a girl. It's very funny.
I was thinking about that.
Yes, that would have been nice. They could tell them. They could trade. They're born with this, you know, similar pairs. They could just trade.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's begin. We're on 15A, Ted Zion Amud Aleph, Ted Vav Amud Aleph. In English, it's 15A2. 15A2. Now, we have been looking at this material rather closely. We have been doing it in great detail. And I think what I'd like to do tonight is to move more quickly, because I think we've set down some of the philosophical ideas, the theological ideas that are relevant. And I think that we would benefit now from seeing a little bit more new material. Some of this material actually comes now, and it comes in a slightly different form in another several pages, so it'll be worth our while to get to all those pages. Okay, and it's not particularly difficult. As you'll see, this is relatively easy Gemara. So it's on 15A2 on the right side of the page, last paragraph. Avel asur bishe elat shalom. A mourner is forbidden to greet other people. And the scriptural source for that was the Amar le Rachmana le Chazkel heanek dom, because the All Merciful said to Ezekiel, heanek dom, grieve and be silent. Now, remember, it's a little bit difficult, this proof text, because we had seen earlier on that Ezekiel was used as a proof text, because remember, Ezekiel's wife is going to get ill, she's going to die, and there's a symbolism in that in terms of God's relation to the Jewish people, and it is going to be so terrible, the destruction that is the Jewish people will suffer, will be so terrible they won't be able to mourn. So we actually learn from that that the instructions to Ezekiel are the opposite of what is normally the custom. You won't be able to mourn. Therefore, when we say, we see that you have to do this and that, we know the opposite is, in fact, the custom of mourning. That's not entirely the case. What the Gemara does is that the Gemara takes part of Ezekiel's instructions and assumes that there has to be some level of public mourning, because something has to show that he's mourning. So at least Eanek Dom. Eanek Dom. Now, perhaps you remember this similar story. Where do we know this kind of story where somebody suffers a loss, it becomes an example then, and the person is not allowed to observe the normal rites of mourning?
Aaron.
And what does it say about Aaron?
Because he's a leader.
He said nothing.
And the Hebrew is?
Dom.
Vayidom Aharon. Vayidom Aharon. Okay? This is Eanek Dom. So my reading of this is that in both those cases, Dom was appropriate. Namely, silence was appropriate. So because we know in the case of Aaron that Aaron was silent and that was a natural response, likewise here in the case of Ezekiel, silence is part of the response to mourning, and it is natural. It is not only something that comes from the outside. So if you look at the Sura Rashi here on the Hebrew side of the page, it's about halfway down. The Ha Amar LeRachman LeYechezkel HaNek Dom. Remember, this is Sura Rashi. This is not Rashi. This is probably Rabbeinu Gershom Me'or HaGola. Klomar b'davar ze tinhog avelut. That is to say, in this matter, you should observe mourning. She tidom, that you should be silent. Velo tishal l'shalom, you shall be silent, and the force of that is you shall not greet people. You shall not greet people. Now, just a connected issue, I think, in just trying to flesh out the psychology of this a little bit. Realize in Hebrew, the way you do that is lish'ol shalom. To greet somebody is to lish'ol bishlomam. If you say, how do you feel, how do you say? Ma shlomcha. What is your peace? All right? Your welfare. And the sense there is that it all is from shalom. And the mourner of all people is not shalem, right? Is the person who is without peace. So the mourner doesn't engage in the inquiries about peace. Now, just in terms of the practical side of this, the mourner is prohibited to greet people. Keep that in mind in terms of a reflection, as we'll make reflections as we go on, particularly of normal mourning practices in America, of Jewish mourning practices, wherever so many mourners, and I've had members of this congregation say to me, do I have to serve? Serve in the home?
Oh.
No, do I have to have a caterer, and what is appropriate for me to put out? People, I would say that's probably the most frequent question that I'm asked about mourning, is how to prepare, not the, how to prepare the mirrors, but how to prepare the caterer. That's the most frequent question. When, of course, this is exactly the opposite. The mourner is given space, and the mourner is, in fact, told not to engage with people. Not to engage with people, rather than feeling. Now, an argument can be made. I mean, I'm not saying that an argument can't be made for the opposite. People have said to me, mourning is a time where you go back, you feel withdrawn, and you go back, and you people lift your spirits. Well, there's some truth to that, and there's no doubt that argument can be made, I think. But the psychology of this, and particularly you'll see as we go further into it, a few pages down the road, at least the initial phase of mourning is such where the mourner is, in effect, expected to be disengaged. And therefore, normal social propriety and the obligation of social propriety, which is not something that is unimportant in Judaism. One is expected to be a social human being. One is expected to have a certain level of grace. This is not one of those places.
I think you once said it's also appropriate for people who are visiting the mourners.
We'll get to that. Oh. Keep in mind that this is saying the mourner, him or herself, should not greet. Okay? You can look, the history of this is really very good. Again, if we wanted to take the time, we could do it. Look at note number 25 down on the bottom. Literally inquiring about the welfare of another. The poskim, that's to say the halachic authorities, dispute which greetings are prohibited, noting the lenient practice of his day, Rama, that's the Mappa of the Shulchan Aruch, suggests that those contemporary greetings were not the ones prohibited by the Gemara. Okay? Be'eretev adds that greetings such as Safra Demare Taf, good morning, which is not actually an inquiry about someone's welfare, would be permissible according to this view. In practice, however, Rama agrees that one may not greet a mourner during the first 30 days of the mourning period, regardless of how the greeting is worded. Now, this comment makes a switch in the middle, which may not be obvious. It changes from the mourner greeting to greeting the mourner. Okay, greeting the mourner is clearly forbidden. Okay, so that when you come into a house of mourning, the appropriate activity is to sit down. That's all. Sit down to say nothing, as opposed to coming in and saying hello or greeting, or whatever the nature of that greeting would be. That's the most appropriate thing to do. It's not always honored, but that's the most appropriate thing to do. Particularly if people are observant people, you don't want to be embarrassed by actually going up to the mourner and engaging in conversation, because it's inappropriate.
apropos this way of mourning, in the beginning of mourning, right after the death, it's very difficult to go to the house, at least for me.
Right after the death, you shouldn't.
Well, when they
because
start
it's not
the Shiva.
Oh, right start, after Shiva. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
okay.
Because they need, I always feel they need space of 2 or 3, 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have to come in.
Mm-hmm.
At the end, they are already adjusted to the fact that mm-hmm. this person is gone.
Mm-hmm.
So they are readier
mm-hmm.
to receive you.
Well, it's part of the process of Shiva does that. You come. Anyone who goes through this knows that you are at the end, not where you were at the beginning. It's extraordinary the change that takes place, the psychological change that takes place as a result of this process. Okay? Next page. Minudeh. The Minudeh, the one who is under a ban of the court. Mahu bishe'elat shalom. Now you will see in each of these cases now, these three are always grouped together. The Avel, the Minudeh, and the Mitzorah. They're always grouped together. Okay, what is the Minudeh in terms of his engaging and greeting other people? Amar Rav Yosef Tashma. Okay, here he's going to bring a Mishnah. This is a Mishnah that we already saw before, where the rabbis have engaged in fasting in order to bring the rains. Remember that? There were a dozen fasts, and then eventually the fasts themselves were ineffective. Okay? And there are more extreme measures that have to be brought on. And at that point, Ubi Sheilat Shalom Shaben Adam Lachavero. Right? The next thing that happens is that they have to refrain from inquiring about the welfare of each other. Okay?
That's the visitors.
Excuse me?
You're talking about the visitors.
We're talking about a minudeh.
Oh, the minudeh.
Minudeh. We are asking about a minudeh. Okay. Whether the minudeh is subject to the same restriction as the avel. And here we see a Mishnah which says that a minudeh, in fact, well, not a minudeh, because that isn't what the Mishnah is about. The Mishnah is about the rabbi sitting on the court after the court has observed 12 fasts in order to bring the rains. At that point, they go into a more extreme type of behavior. And among the things they do, b'she'elat shalom sheben adam lachavero. And they are not allowed at that point to ask for the welfare of their fellows. Kivne adam en nuzufim lamakom. Like people who are rebuked by the ever-present. Okay? So in other words, the people The rabbis see themselves as menudim. They are menudim. They've been put away from God. And they are acting, therefore, like menudim. And, of course, it says that they should not ask b'she'elat shalom. They are not allowed to greet. Okay? But the Gemara responds to that. It's a nice argument. It's a good argument. Wow. Gemara says, Amar le'abaye dilme menude le'shamayim shana. We saw the same argument once before. Maybe somebody who is under a ban from heaven is in a different condition. And remember, the ban that a menude is suffering from is a humanly produced ban.
Not
okay?
Natural.
Right? God has created the ban of the rain.
Right.
Right? And the rabbis feel the distance from God, but can you therefore learn an analogy from the people being menude to God and one person being menudeh to a human court? Okay? Okay? So it doesn't really answer that question, but all we know is that it's not obvious that you can create the analogy which seemed so tempting just a moment ago. Okay? And in fact, now the Gemara leaves this, as several left it once before in discussing the menudeh and a comparison with the avel. And among the halachic authorities, they're really not sure what the law is here. All these cases, they're not sure what it is because it's not addressed. And generally speaking, in the area of avelut, of mourning, where there is a question about the law, it always goes to the more lenient possibility. You are always more lenient in terms of the laws of mourning. The real question is, though, this is not actually the laws of mourning. This is the laws of nidui, of being under a ban. And therefore, is it correct to create yet another analogy, which is to say, in the laws of mourning, we take the lenient position. And therefore, in the laws of nidui, of being under a ban, we take the lenient position. That analogy itself, we're not sure that we can do. So that's why the rabbis have a lot of trouble with this material. Yes.
And if the avel is a menudeh?
And it's easy.
If the avel is a menudeh, you also take the lenient position, right?
No way, because then we know. It's not that we know there's a lenient position and we know there's a stringent position. There's a questionable position and there's the position of the avel. So if there's one clear and one unclear, you go according to the clear one. Okay? So in fact, you go according to the avel. That's clear.
Is the practice of nidui still exist? Is it
yep.
Based in here?
Yep. It exists in Israel, you'll find it.
In Israel?
In Israel, people will do it.
From a Beit Din? Or
yep.
And here in the U.S.?
No. And to my knowledge, it's not done. People threaten to do it, but it's laughable. Because rabbis have no power in this country. In Israel, they do have power.
Yes, it's
correct. I shouldn't say it's not done at all because it is possible in communities. I just read last week. Maybe you read this. I don't know where I read this, but this is a current controversy in Muncie. There's one of the rabbis who was accused of sexual harassment. And some of the local rabbis accepted the evidence, and the congregation didn't want to fire him because they stepped in and said it couldn't be, not our rabbi. So in communities like that, in places like Muncie, you conceivably do have a community where you can have some effective rabbinic ban. It's possible. And I suppose it does happen.
All of the things that we're studying on these pages about the three categories, the rules as they apply to an avel, are they all the same for an onen or some?
No, they're completely different for an onen.
They're
going to
be different.
What we are learning for an avel is not necessarily in any way appropriate for an onen. You cannot assume that one is the same thing.
Some are, but some aren't.
Correct. Because you'll see the laws of the onen, There's an overlap. It's an overlap. An Onan can't study the Torah.
Right. Okay, see, that's next.
So that'll be an overlap. That's an overlap. But it's not necessarily because of the same thing.
Just go back to the last subject for a moment. Believe it or not, I was once retained by a rabbi who was being threatened with proceedings in the Beis Din that would excommunicate him for conduct that he was engaged in.
Mm-hmm. So, what happened?
How to say this not modestly, I mean, when it became not a group of people involved in the community gotten together and they decided that they would retain a lawyer from a, you know, big substantial firm.
They got cold feet.
Threatening that it would be a public matter. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it went away.
Yeah. That's frequently how these things are dealt with.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very interesting. Very interesting. Okay. We go on. So now we have dealt with the Avel and the Menudeh. Who's left? The Mitzorah. The Mitzorah. Mitzorah mahu b'she'elat shalom. How about a Mitzorah? Is he permitted to greet other people? Tashma. Va'al safam yate. Right? This was the quote from the Torah, that it says that the Mitzorah has to bind up his lip. And you remember we said that that referred to Atifat HaRosh, to the wrapping of the head in some form, and we discussed that last time. Here the Gemara takes the same concept and uses it to learn something slightly different. She used Siftotav Midubakot Zobazo, that his lips shall be clung together one with the other. That is to say that he's not allowed to speak. That is the force then of saying, Al safam yateh, he shall cover his mouth. That is a metaphor for saying that he should not talk. He should not talk. And the force of that is, lo bishelat shalom. He should not greet other people. Okay? Now, here, of course, we could wonder why that is. It's easy to take the second step. The first step, we ask the mourner has distance. The minudeh is an enforced distance. You want to alienate the person from the community. You want to enforce that fact that the court says you don't abide by the will of the court and you get pushed away. The Mitzorah, of course, hasn't done anything to be punished, but the Mitzorah is a good practical explanation for this. What do you think? It's contagion, right? When you, in fact, enforce a certain separation between the Mitzorah and the community, then it's good for the community. So maybe that's what it is, but certainly the Gemara does not say that. Now, let's see, I think. Safam. The Tosafot. Take a look at the Tosafot on the. Tosafot is now on the left side of the Talmud page. And the Rashi is on the right side, right next to the Talmud text. Tosafot on the left side, or normally Rashi, what we expect to be Rashi is on the right side. Tosafot is on the left side. Tosafot were, again, French commentators of the generation and two after Rashi. Okay? So look right in the middle of the Tosafot. It says, Shiyehu Siftotav Medubakot. See that? Shiyehu siftotav medubakot, that his lips shall be stuck together. That was al safam yateh. That's what the Torah says. Al safam yateh. Now, what does the word safam mean in Hebrew?
Mustache,
right. So it doesn't mean what we think it's supposed to mean. If it meant what we supposed to, what it's supposed to mean, what should it have said? Al Safa or Al Siftotav or something like that, but not Al Safam. Okay, so also from is obviously an odd usage here. So Tosafot says she uses tatam edubakot le'el darshinin minei atifatarosh. Above, we learn from the same verse about wrapping the head. Normally, you only learn one law from one verse. So how could we learn two laws from one verse? Okay, v'shema tarvayu mashma. Maybe in this case you learn two laws from one verse, the Tosafot says. Inami, or midichtiv safam velokativ safa. Maybe because it is written safam and not safa, we have therefore the possibility to learn an additional thing from the verse. And that's the take this latter explanation as the correct one. That normally you only learn one thing from the verse. If there is something unusual about the verse, then you can learn something else from it as well. But it was the first thing that we learned, this, the Atifat Arosh, was just the plain meaning of the verse. It was the plain meaning of the verse. In order to be able to get another drasha out of it, another interpretation out of it, you need to point to something unusual in that verse, and that is safam instead of safa. Okay?
In both of these cases with the menudeh and the metzora, it's specifically forbidding that person to greet other people.
Correct.
But what about the community greeting them?
That's down the road. That's coming later. Okay? But you're right. That is what is referred to so far is just the person himself engaging others. Correct. So we'll limit it to that for now, even though the others will come in as well later on. Okay? Therefore, this is a pretty good argument that the Gemara has now made, and therefore the Gemara says, Shmamina, yes, listen to this. This is the law. Shmamina. Okay? Okay, now the Gemara says, Nifshot mine limenude. Well, perhaps one can extrapolate from this, which we've now had a Shmaminat about a Mitzorah. Maybe we can learn from the Mitzorah about the Minude. Okay, because we were just with the Minude before and we didn't come to a conclusion. Amar Rav Acha bar Pinchas Mishmei de Rav Yosef, Mi katani sha'asur. Is it written? Oh. Let's go back. Let's go back to the Minude and see the language. The second 29. This is not a good. It doesn't make it obvious here. I don't think they quote in the notes what is going on here. The minudeh, when the 12 fasts have been made, the rabbis then will go into this more severe level of response, and then it says, Kim minudeh v'che'avel, like a minudeh and like an avel. Okay? So if the question is, well, and all of these three things are put together. So if we see there's a comparison between any one or two especially, then perhaps all three should be. You know, if one A is equal to B and B is equal to C, then A is equal to C. Right? So that we've seemed to have that here. We have the we have the avel, and we have the mitzora. So maybe, therefore, we can, since we almost were able to create an analogy with the mourner, maybe now we should be able to do it with the mitzorah. All right, so Rav Acha bar Pinchas says, Mi katani asur. Did the Braita say that a mitzorah should be like an excommunicate who is forbidden to greet people? Look at the verse in the Mitzora. Sheyehu siftotav medubakot zo bazo. His lips shall be
sealed
to each other. Sheyehe kemenudeh ucha avel. That he will be like a menudeh. All right? So we now know that the Metzora is not allowed to grip it. He shall be like a Menudeh. Like a Menudeh. And like an Avil. So he said twice. So now let's see on the Menudeh side. Okay? Should learn from that. Now look at the language. The language says, it doesn't say that he should be like a Menudeh, that Sha'asur, that he is forbidden to greet people. Doesn't say that. Doesn't say. Look what it says. It says that his lips have to cling together. This is the Metzora. And I'll put an end in there, comma, or dash. That one thing is that his lips have to cling together. Okay? And in other things he shall be like a Menudeh and an Avel. Okay? I could say that. But why do I have to assume that they're all the same? It's just a matter of punctuation. So that's what the Gemara is going to say here. Shehekim Menudeh Avel Katani Bemile Achronaita. In other things. So, on the one hand, the Metzora, we know, is not allowed to greet people. Okay? And in other ways, he's also like a Menudeh and an Avel. Which is not to say that in all ways, but in other ways. V'asur nami b'she'ela chalom. Okay? And the Metzora is also prohibited in she'ela chalom. That's the Metzora, but not the Menudeh. Okay. Avel asor b'divrei Torah. Now it goes on. The person who is in mourning is prohibited to study the Torah. Midaka marachmana le'echezkel dom. It's interesting. Because the All-Merciful said to Ezekiel, Heyanek dom, be silent. Absolute silence implies no study of the Torah. The Torah is the most basic of all noises. Okay? The Torah is the source of all noise, of all movement. All right? It's interesting. It's because it's not literally, it doesn't say that, but that is the implication of it. And that's what the Gemara understands, and there's no argument about that at all. So when it says Ha'anek Dom, it refers also to Torah study.
Was that because in those days it was like oral?
And not only in those days. Torah study is correct. Torah study is considered to be an oral medium. That's correct.
Isn't it traditional to study Mishnah at someone studies, reads something from the Mishnah?
Correct. But you don't. That's why you study something in a rather structured fashion.
Rather what?
Structured fashion. How do we choose the Mishnah? How do you choose a Mishnah?
The initials of the person.
Oh,
correct. You would choose it by initials of a person's name. Okay? So what you do, we always try to get around the thing we're not allowed to study Torah. We do some sort of Torah study, but you try to keep it in line, because not all Torah study is forbidden. In fact, there are things that you can study. So you try to study those things that just seem appropriate. Of course, what is Torah also? Torah is considered joyful. The Simchat Torah. Torah is a source of joy. And you don't introduce sources of joy into the morning context. It's simply inappropriate.
Is that the only time that you're forbidden from reading Torah?
No, there's one other time. You know when that time is? On Tisha B'Av.
Is it the joyful too?
Correct, because both are times of mourning. Both are times of mourning, and both those times have forbidden Torah study, and as well, in both those cases, there's forbidden and there's permitted Torah study as well. Because we just would never say it's done.
You'll never say you can't.
Absolutely.
You have to find a way around. That's
when you first
great.
Said it, though, I thought that it also implied the Torah study is active in that you are supposed to speak. So, you know, like the oral Torah is, you can listen, but this means that the person is not allowed to speak, which means the Torah study implies an activity and a questioning that's active. And
it probably does.
Speaking.
Well, that's probably right.
Also a communal activity, because people didn't have their own. I mean, nowadays we have our own at home, but back then I would think it was not something people did in the privacy of their home.
Sure. It's true. Yeah.
Is there an explanation for why we can learn two different rules from Hayanig Dom? One that you don't
Let me just think. Let's see. I think there's a comment here. Let me see. I did read an explanation. The question is where?
Number 37 in the English
Revelation. It also said that in as much as both silences and natural concomitants agree. Well, so sort of. Let's see. See also Tosafot. Where does Tosafot comment on that? What's the name of it? I don't see a Tosafot comment on that.
What is Tosafot to Kesubot 6b?
Oh, is that what it is? Sorry.
What is the question?
We are learning two things out of Hayanig Dom. We learn that you're not supposed to ask Shelat Shalom. Mm-hmm. And number two, that you're not supposed to study Torah. And I made the general principle before that usually in the rabbinic literature you don't learn two things from one verse unless there's something special about that verse. So Dan is asking, what's special about that verse that we're learning two things? And I don't have a ready answer for it.
He's looking at the Tosafot speak before the one that you read. In the prior discussion, that he addresses it there.
But that's what I said before, isn't it? That's what I talked about before. It doesn't answer Dan's question. It does not answer the question. Okay? So leave that question unanswered. Okay? Of course, the Tosafot's other answer before was sometimes it is that way. So that's a good answer. But I'd like to have another answer also.
So it's any verse in Tanakh altogether? I thought it was only Torah verses.
It's usually replaced first everything. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Amar b'divrei Torah. Amar Rav Yosef Tashma. Oh, so and now we're up to the Minudah. So we want to know about the Minudah. Is the Minudah also prohibited to study Torah? Amar Rav Yosef Tashma. Okay, here we are. We have a breakdown. Minudeh shoneh v'shonin lo. A minudeh may study. I would say teach is not. Shoneh is to study. V'shonin lo, and they study to him. Namely, they teach him. So a minudeh can study and can be taught. Niskar v'niskarin lo. He may be hired by others, and others may be hired by him. Muhram, however, a person who's in chayram, that's the more severe condition, that's excommunication. Lo shoneh v'lo shonin lo. He cannot study and cannot teach, and they don't teach him. Lo niskar, he may not be hired, v'lo niskarin lo, and others may not be hired to work for him. Aval he may learn by himself, shelo yafsik et limudo, so that he will not interrupt his studies. Okay? This is the muhram, the person who's in cherem. Vaoselo chanut ketana bishvil parnasato. And he can open up a little store. So that he can have a little business.
So you can do business with a person.
V'amar Rav, Zabuni Maya Befakta da Arvot. He may sell water in the market of Aravot. Now, here the commentators say, see if we can look at the Rashi here. Look at the Rashi, the Pseudo Rashi. Befakta. the Aravot Bishuk Shel Otomakom, or the regular Rashi. Regular Rashi has, let's see where he is here. Chanut Katana, let me read to you, this is now three lines from the bottom in the Rashi manuscript, down in the bottom. Bishvil Chanut Katana, he can open up a small store, Bishvil Parnasato, to make a living. Klomar, Miyut Melacha Kedei Parnasa, he can do a little bit of labor, Kedei Parnasa, in order to make a living. My Chanut Katana, and what the, his manuscript said, my, what is the meaning of a little store? What is the meaning of that? Okay, that he can have a little store. Zavuni mai befukta ta arvot. He can sell water in the Arvot Valley. Pikta bika shabaotomakom. Pikta in Aramaic means a bika, a valley in that place. Ein shamayim. All right? It was a place that, because just think to yourself, what kind of business is water selling? It's not such a great business. So this was in a place which was particularly dry, says Rashi. I have a different explanation. I have a different explanation than this. I think it means exactly the opposite of what Rashi said. Because Aravos, where do Aravot grow? All right, Nachal, Nachale Mayim. All right, Arve Nachal, we say, Arve Nachal. Arve Nachal is Aravos grow next to the water. That's a weeping willow tree. Doesn't grow in a dry place. It grows in a wet place.
So he's allowed to sell ice to the Eskimo.
Exactly. That's what is being said here. He can go to work. He can sell ice to the Eskimos. He can sell water to the people who live by a river. All right? That's the kind of work this guy can get. Okay? All right, you read my article when I publish it.
And how's he going to make a living?
Right?
He's a good salesman.
I have a guy who gets excommunicated, it's his problem. Right?
No wonder this version was suppressed.
So you think I'm right? That's what I think. That's the force of the thing. I think it fits much better. It really fits much better.
How long would this period last that they're setting up a small business?
Well, the somebody who's in cherem can be for any fixed period of time. Normal cherem, the commentators say, it's automatic after three prior niduis. So if you've been under three bans, three strikes and you're out, okay? So at that point you become an excommunicant. Or that's a more serious option that the court has even at the beginning, okay?
Court has the right to do what?
To excommunicate you, to put you under a cherem.
I'm surprised that the
Menudah
is allowed to teach Torah. I mean, this is somebody who's
quadrant
rabbinic authority.
Isn't it fascinating? It's amazing.
How is he going to improve if he's cut off in Torah?
Yeah, but who would want to learn from that?
Well, the truth is, some of the great Menudim were great teachers. Spinoza. In the Talmud itself.
Yeah, that's why they were
in the Talmud itself, you had people like Elisha ben Abuya.
Oh.
Elisha ben Abuya.
Wasn't he a convert?
No, he's one of the four.
But he went into paradise. He went into paradise, correct, and he came out injured. Okay? But he was a great teacher of Torah.
Right. Yeah. Was Reish
Lakish. Correct?
Like a bandit.
You had a variety of different people who at different times were under nidui for not listening. Rabbi Eliezer,
for what kinds of things?
For not listening, for not holding heeding out that their opinion was right.
Okay. So
and that's okay, but they acted according to their opinion. You can hold out that your opinion is right, but you have to go according to what the court says. You do according to what you think, then you're on there in deep trouble.
Then Abuya was a good teacher before.
But that the Baraita is fascinating. It's just so fascinating that you might have thought what you said, because it's perfectly logical what you're saying. Perfectly logical.
Whenever I think it's logical, I'm always wrong.
No, not always. Not always.
But these were not moral lapses. These were this had to do with kind of conviction, I would think.
And realize that there's a reason given here. Let's see. Where is it that? Oh, as far as the Mukhram goes, is that right? Is that Mukhram? Yes. Aval shonehu liatzmo. Right, that's the Mukhram. It's allowed to teach himself. Shelo yafsik et Talmudo. So that he does not stop his learning. If you look at the note on 42, the Rif and the Rosh have a different manuscript, and there it says Yafsid et Limudo, which is probably right. Shelo Yafsid et Limudo, that he not lose the learning he already has. And I think that to me is probably the crucial issue here, that learning requires constant repetition. And even if the guy has gone wrong, still, we don't want a person to lose the Torah that they have. It's not going to do anybody any good. It's not going to do him any good. It's not going to do the community any good. And therefore, it's important to keep up the Torah study.
The word shoneh means to repeat.
Repeat, correct. That's right.
The shoneh.
The week of Martin Luther King, this is actually civil disobedience.
Of a kind. It's a kind of civil disobedience. There's no doubt about it. Of a kind, I would say. It makes it sound too good when we compare it to Martin Luther King. There's a certain kind of disobedience, which is also arrogance.
Yeah.
You know.
Okay.
There's a certain intellectual arrogance, which is really, I think, what they're reacting against here. It's the arrogance of the learned.
But the rulers always think the civil disobedient is arrogant.
Yes, it could be. But sometimes arrogant people are arrogant.
Yeah, at that time, did the rabbi ever thought that by making somebody memenudeh, they're helping him become a better leader into the future?
I think that they assumed that he would get the message sooner or later.
No, but what happened usually, if he has an opinion, one group pushes him aside, he can generate his own group that overcomes the first group. And
it's
that's
possible.
Usually what happens when you have a struggle of power in regards of academic opinion. Or other opinion of life.
Usual, I'm not sure in that context whether that's usually what happened, because social reprobation is so strong that people basically give in after a while. They just don't hold out because they don't want to be alone. Where you have a really strongly functioning community, it has amazing power. In our community, we don't think that way because we don't live in a world where we're... you know, if you don't like what they say about you here, you go elsewhere. It's very different in a world where there is no elsewhere.
Yeah, but it's very true.
Some of the revolutionary leaders were in jail, and that what helped them to become
correct.
The leader.
Correct. It's true. But that, I tend to think, is a more modern thing. I'm not sure that happened so much in the ancient world.
If we derive that an Avel cannot learn Torah from the verse which says he must be silent, why is he worse than someone who is in Chayram, who can learn by himself and can do that silently?
Because this is a temporary thing, the Aved.
Well, because we have an analogy doesn't mean that it's for the same reason. We've seen that again and again here. The Avel, as I said to you before, the Avel, Torah is a source of joy.
Right.
It's inappropriate to the emotions of Avelut. Okay? The Benudeh, a totally different issue is being really discussed here.
But
the minudeh is being alienated from the structures of the community as a form of punishment. I don't think that this particular side of it is punishment, although we read Soloveitchik last week, and Soloveitchik did raise the possibility that this is punishment. It's all a form of it can be a form of expiation. But I think that you can have that for the minudeh, and it doesn't have to be the same reason for the avil.
What you say is logical, and there's a philosophical construct, but it's not what the Talmud is saying.
Why?
The Talmud is saying the reason is because there is the verse from Yecheskel which says to be silent, and it's deriving the prohibition of learning Torah for a need to be silent. So if someone in Cheiron, I'm repeating the question again, if someone in Cheiron can learn silently to himself, why is someone who is an Avel in a worse position that he could not learn silently to himself? Mm-hmm. He would still be observing what is intended from the reference to Yecheskel by being silent.
To the contrary. I think that because the rabbis do not see them together, the real question that we have is, why do they not see them together? You can't say, they must see them together because of the logic that you've brought to the situation. Rather, the fact is they don't see them together. That's what's clear from the text. And the question is, well, what's the difference between them?
And that leads you to your philosophical
explanation. Correct.
Well, so the first thing Yecheskel is specifically about mourning. The rabbis are drawing the distinction here and saying, because that was about mourning, what now is the rule for the new death?
I was going back, though, to analyzing in the context of the prior.
And I don't think that you should assume that it has to be the same for the Avel, the Minudeh, and the Tzarah. It is a formalistic way of presenting law, that we do know that there are connections between these three. But because there are connections between these three, we do not have to assume that they're all the same and that they all must be the same, even though each of these is presented in that way. It is presented in terms first of the Avel, then the Menudah, and the Mitzorah. This is a formalistic, structural way in which the Gemara has decided to present the material. Okay? You can get a certain amount of analogy from that, but you can't take it too far. Okay? Let's go on. So that was my store for ice to the Eskimos. Okay, so Shema Mina, as a result of the Beraita, we now know that somebody who is a Menudeh is permitted to learn the Torah. Now, I don't know about you, but I now want to know about the Metzorah. Because it seems to me that the issue of the Menudeh is so logical. It's what it came out the way I wanted it to come out. Question is now, how's the next one going to come out? Okay? All right, Mitzorah. Mahu b'divrei Torah. Tashma. All right, come and hear. V'hodatam levanecha v'livnei vanecha. This is a verse about the revelation at Mount Sinai. And you shall make them known to your children and to your children's children. Okay? Yom asher amadata lifnei Hashem Elokecha b'choreth. The day, that's the next verse, the day that you stood before the Lord your God at Horeb, namely at Mount Sinai. Horeb is Mount Sinai. Okay? All right? Now, these two verses, verse 9 and verse 10, you shall announce them to your children. You should announce them to your children. How do you announce them to your children?
Teachers.
You teach them, because that's the issue now we're learning about teaching. Okay? Yom Asher Amadta Lifnei Hashem B'Chorev. It was the day that you stood before the Lord. How were you before the Lord at Horeb? Ma lahalan be'ema uveyira beretet. At Horeb, you are in fear and in trembling. Right? That's the way you received the Torah. You received the Torah that way. So should you be teaching the Torah in fear and trembling? In fear and trembling. That's sort of left out in the text, and commentators say, well, there's probably a missing section here of our text. Mikan Amru. From here they learned. It's very important what's going to be said. It's a very interesting concept. hazavin v'hametzoraim uboale nidot mutarim likrot batara uvaneviim uvakatuvim v'lishnot b'midrash ubeshas b'alachot ubagadot uvale krayin asurim. This is all sex. And here you got to see the sex behind it. Right? We learned that the Torah was given, and that was teaching to your children. It was given amid fear and trembling, and therefore must be taught amid fear and trembling. Those who are able to fear and tremble can teach the Torah. That's what you would learn from this. Therefore, the Baraita says, Mikan Amru Hazavin. Azav is somebody who has a genital excretion which is not of a normal nature. A woman who is a Zava, this is a non-menstrual type of bleeding in most cases. Not only, that's not the only possibility, but that's the most common one. Okay, it's not menstruation, but it's other. And in the male case of this, it's an equal male and female. The male is a non-seminal type of a flow from the genital. Okay, that's azav. So the question is, if you have such things coming out of the sexual organs, can you study the Torah? Can you study the Torah? The answer is yes. You can definitely study the Torah. Okay? The Hamitzaraim. Oh, the Mitzara is in the same category. Okay? The Mitzara has a physical problem. And the Mitzara can study the Torah. Even though they're all Tmeim. They're all Tmeim. These are all states of ritual impurity. Even these states of ritual impurity do not exclude the person from the study of the Torah. All right? So a Zav can study the Torah. A Metzora is Tamei, can study the Torah. Uboale Nidot. Ay vey, this is a man who has sexual relations with a woman who is menstruating. Okay? Now that makes him Tamei. It makes him Tamei. The assumption here, according to the Rashi, is, of course, after that he goes to the mikveh.
Before he studies Torah?
Excuse me?
Before he studies Torah?
Yeah, because there are really two issues there. Oh. There are two issues. One is the tumah that he received from the relation. He becomes, she's tameh, he becomes tameh too. Okay, that's one thing. The second thing is a different kind of tumor, which is a rabbinic tumor, which comes from ejaculation. Ejaculation itself is a source of tumor. It's a source of tumor, okay? Of ritual impurity. Now, therefore, all of these cases where a person is in a normal state of tumor, the person can study Torah. Mutarim likrot batara, they can read the Torah. Uvanavim, and they can study the prophets. Uvakatuvim, and the writings. Vilishnot b'midrash, and they can study the midrash. Ubeshas, okay, they can study the Talmud. Ubahalachot b'agadot, so you can study everything. Gituma. The point is that tumah has nothing to do. It does not create an impediment to study. Okay? Uvale krayin asurim. But someone who is a balkeri is forbidden to study the Torah.
What's a balkeri?
Funny you should ask. Okay, what is a balkeri? A balkeri, the normal meaning of the balkeri is somebody who has a man who has a nocturnal emission. Right? The rabbis understood that nocturnal emissions are together with lascivious thoughts. If you are involved in such thoughts, you can't study Torah. Then you can't study. Then the nature of your tumah excludes your study of Torah. Why?
Spiritual.
Because Torah was given and taught how? Beretatu bezeya, in fear and trembling. And somebody who has sex is not in fear and trembling. Sex is it makes you get out of fear and trembling. The very experience, when you're involved in sex, you don't think about fear and trembling, right? It's the opposite. Now, let's just, in case, I'm not telling you my opinion, this is the rabbi's. Okay?
Why is he being treated worse than all that?
Yeah, that's an
odd one. Come, we'll read the Rashi. The Rashi manuscript.
Also
gotta
this
read.
Why this tractate is not generally taught in high schools. It's harder, they don't have to study the
numbers.
If this were taught in high schools, the students would be much more dedicated to the study of Torah than I think is usually the case.
We studied about the Baal Kira, and then
they're going to get to it.
Against the Mikvah.
Correct. I'll get to that in a minute. We studied about this in Masechet Brachot, so I'll get to that in just a minute. But first, let's see if we can understand the text. Now, this is two lines from the bottom of the page, all about six words in. Ubo ale nidot. Men who have intercourse with menstruating women. Remember, that the woman is tmeya, she is ritually impure because of the menstruation. The minute he enters her, he becomes ritually impure as well. And that takes several days to recover from, as it were. Then he can go to the mikveh for that at that point. But once he has ejaculated, that's a different kind of tumah. That's a more immediate tumah that all he has to do then is an hour later go to the mikveh, you can get rid of that. So two different kinds of tumor. Keep that in mind. You like this, Francis?
I think this.
You're glad you came to me. I tell you, you never know what you're going to read in the Talmud. You just don't know. You were reading about people in the house of mourning. You didn't think you'd be in sex. You never know. Okay, boale nitot. Having relations with menstruating women. Nami. Afal pishemitoch kalut rosh. Even though it was amidst kalut rosh, levity. How do you say that? What's a good
lightheaded.
Name?
Lightheaded.
What?
Lightheadedness.
Lightheadedness. Good.
Frivolity.
Okay. Baal etenida. He has intercourse with this menstruant woman. Liacharkein libo doeg mechamat achet. Afterwards, he realizes that he has committed a sin because you're not allowed to have intercourse with a menstruating woman. Okay? It's against the law of the Torah. You're not allowed to do that.
Who told him to say anything?
All right. So this is the Rashi manuscript. Rashi manuscript is saying, if the standard here is fear and trembling, this guy, even though he went into the sex without fear and trembling, or he wouldn't have done it in the first place. Afterwards, once he realizes what he did, what is he filled with? Fear and trembling.
Oh,
okay? So he got himself into trouble. So now he's filled with fear and trembling.
So
one of the positive sides of that is that he can study Torah.
Oh. Now you're so worried that
okay.
You can now study Torah.
Aval, he says, Baale Kerian. Those who have emissions, all right, the assumption being here, Baal Keri in its pure form, in the Torah's form, is somebody who has a nocturnal emission. Im ra'u keri bi'alma, if that's the only thing that's involved, is that emission. Mitoch simcha, that is done as a result of joy. V'kalut rosh, and lightheadedness. Who? V'chein im shimesh mitato. Similarly, if he has sex in general, nami lo beretetu, it's not done in fear and trembling. Who? D'simcha hu lo. Rather, it's a simcha for a person to do something like that. Right. That's what you call just plain simcha. This is very interesting in terms of Jewish attitudes towards sex. I mean, if you would just compare this to St. Augustine, for example. I mean, just a little piece of Talmud like this to compare to a good Catholic writer, it's just so incredibly different. I mean, if you want to be a good spiritual person, you can't do any of these things. But here it's a matter of just, it depends on when you do it, how you do it. There's room for simcha, sex is simcha. Then you have to have fear and trembling for your Torah study. You know, this now, that, then. It can all work. You shouldn't mix these things too much. They don't work together all the time. But one, you should do the, you should certainly do them both. Okay? So, that's what you learned in Talmud class tonight, yes.
This doesn't fit what we were talking about before, that to study Torah is a simcha. But here it's fear and trembling.
Correct, you're right. You're right. Correct. It does not fit, it does not fit with that. Of course, the thing we said before, I said.
Yeah, right.
It was a commentary.
Right, right.
This is what the Talmud says.
It sounds like we're coming out is if someone is a Baal Keri and he goes to the mikvah, he gets rid of the Keri and then he's free to do whatever he needs to do, including learning Torah. So the restriction could be for a very short period of time because he can get rid of the problem by going to the mikvah. But the person who had, the man who had sex with the menstruate, even if he goes to the mikvah, he's still going to be tummy in some sense for a period of time.
Right,
so the Torah is giving a lighter, restriction on him. So he's still free to study Torah.
Correct.
Because
if it would be too long,
it for him.
Yeah, and if it would be too long, we can't take away a person from the study of Torah for that long.
That's really the lesson.
Maybe.
The emission was involuntary. The having sex with a menstruating woman is voluntary.
But I'm not sure what Balkari means here.
Yeah.
The Balkari also is not necessarily involuntary. Because the use of the Talmud's term Balkari, eventually what that comes to mean in the time of the Talmud, if you remember the Takanat Ezra Sofer, Ezra, the scribe, decided that he would legislate a law which would prohibit the study of Torah to anyone who had had an emission. An emission either unwillingly, that is to say, without clear forethought, or clear forethought, which is to say, in an act of sex. Okay? In both those cases, a person would not be able to study Torah unless he went to the mikveh. Unless he went to the mikveh. And the purpose of that was, do you remember what the purpose was? Ezra says the purpose is so that Talmidei Chachamim will not relate to their wives as roosters do to chickens.
As what?
Roosters do to chickens. That is to say, as sex objects. That they won't always be knocking on the doors to come and to have sex with their wives.
Why? Because they have to go to the mikveh afterward.
You put an impediment. A Talmid Chacham wants to study Torah.
Oh,
he wants to study Torah. If you tell him every time he studies Torah he has to go to the mikveh, what does that mean? Practically speaking, it means he'll have less sex. He'll have less sex because he knows what's more important. What's more important is to study more Torah. So it discourages the amount of sex that a person will have.
Yeah.
Remember what the Talmud says. This was Ezra's brilliant idea.
The chickens are not happy.
Well, that's not what the Talmud says. Wait, let me finish what the Talmud says. The Talmud says that the Talmidei Chachamim didn't abide by the law. Therefore, the law was canceled. The law was canceled. So this is one of the classic examples where if the community will not accept upon itself a law that its rabbis think is for its good, in fact, the law is rejected.
That's
and it is not the law. That is the story. That's what we learn in Masechet Brachot. And when you look at the law, it's just fascinating to see this. And sometimes you have to see, people don't realize this law of Balkari. They remember the Takanat Ezra, and the Takanat Ezra is used, and every once in a while people want to bring that back, and it never works. It's just one of these laws that's not really very Jewish, and it just doesn't work.
Yeah,
It's not that it can't work, because look, I think other religions do try to really achieve those things. Far be it for me to say whether they achieve them or not, but it's certainly basic to them. But in Judaism, it just really doesn't seem right. It doesn't work. I'm sorry.
I was just wondering the social implications of this. When they go to the mikveh, do they have to announce why they're going? So
no, as a matter of fact, you don't even have to go to the mikveh. Because the law of the Balkari of Ezra, the Takana of Ezra, was enough to wash yourself with Tisha Kabin of Mayim, only 9 kavs of water. So that in fact, it was an easier type of purification. But in some of the commentators ask that, though. So they'll see somebody says, all I need is 9 kav. They say, oh-ho. Oh-ho, you have 9 kavs. We know what that means.
And the water from the, buy the water from the
But the bottom line is, remember, none of this worked. It all went by the wayside. Yes, sir.
Just as a piece of information, Steinsaltz indicates that although the Amoraim eliminated that Takana of Ezra, there is a Hasidic minhag which reinstates it for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know in my community in Jerusalem, a large number of people go to the mikveh every single day. Men. Go every single day. When you buy a talis bag, for example, when I went to buy a talis bag, my friend who sold me the talis bag said, do you want it with room for a towel?
Oh,
wow.
With room for a towel.
It's like a gym bag.
With a towel. It's like a gym bag, correct. Exactly. Because you take it to the... Because you go first to the mikveh, and then you go to shacharit. You go to the mikveh before you go to shacharit. And every morning the mikveh is full. The men's mikveh in the old city is full of men. And this is the idea there. If you go to the mikveh, the assumption is if you go every morning, that of course, you know, it takes care of issues like this. That's not the only reason to go, but that surely is a reason to go. And just becomes a part of daily procedure. Yes, that is an issue. It is an issue, and it does affect the severity of the penalty. It does affect.
And is there the obligation of the woman to disclose?
Yeah. To disclose? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes, she has an obligation to disclose.
But her the consequences for her are not.
My assumption is, in fact, that this is not what it appears to be on the surface. That it's just inconceivable to me that you're really talking about somebody who is a Bo'el Nida, because it just doesn't happen. The truth is, in that system, it's just about inconceivable that you could do it. I mean, it's such a terrible thing. It's just not done. It's just not... I don't think that that's really what's meant here. I think that what is meant here is what you're referring to now, where you discover after intercourse that she was a menstruant. That in fact she wipes herself and she's bleeding. And then the question is, what is the source of the blood? Is it a result of the intercourse? Is it a result of the of menstruation? And is there sufficient reason to assume that there is enough doubt to assume that she was menstruating during the intercourse? That's what I think is really being referred to. So it is not an intentional state. It's the assumption is it's an unintentional state to begin with.
If Torah study is with Ema Yira, and sex is B'Simcha, I get the feeling that when one studies Torah, that mitigates the sexual urge. It
could be.
And I think that's behind a lot of the thinking mm-hmm. in the Talmud.
Mm-hmm. Could be. That the Torah is seen as a control of the Yetzer.
Yeah.
That you have to drag the Yetzer into the house of study and try to control it there by the act of the Torah study. That's an interesting thing, though. You know this, the story that's in the Talmud elsewhere of the rabbis after the destruction of the first temple. After the destruction of the first temple, the Talmud says that the experience of the destruction was so great that from that point on there is no more Yetzer for Avodah Zorah. There's no more desire to worship idols. And we see that. Once the destruction is over, there is never again a problem of idolatry in Judaism. And you read the prophets, it was such a problem during the First Temple period, suddenly finished. Nothing exists anymore. So it was pretty effective. I mean, obviously the punishment worked. It worked very well. Simply it doesn't happen again. So the rabbis realized that. It was very effective. And they figured it was an Eit Ratzon. It was a time when God was being particularly good to his people. So they said, it's such a good time, we will ask God to get rid of the Yetzer entirely.
And where was the part of it?
So they get, God says, so God listens, and it was an Eit Ratzon. So God says, all right, we'll get rid of the Yetzer entirely. And then the Talmud says, no chicken lay an egg. No man looked at a woman. No woman looked at a man. And the world was on its way to destruction. After which the rabbis suddenly realized what was going on. And they said, please, take away what we said. It was a bad idea. So God takes it away and instead introduces blinders on the horse. That's the
oh my God.
Blinders on the horse. So in other words, instead of not having a Yetzer, we need the Yetzer. The Yetzer is very good. But we need to have certain blinders so that you look in one direction and not all over. And that is, in fact, the purpose of the law. The law controls and does not get rid of desire. The idea is to control but not get rid of desire.
It's okay. The idea of why it starts with a B, with a bet.
Why?
The back is closed, you should go backwards.
Okay.
But I mean, if the covenant is to be so plentiful, and you know, today I happen to read that the world's Jewish population is shrinking, and the implications. So you've got to calibrate this right. Because you can turn it up too high and you can turn it down too low, and both have serious consequences.
Well, I don't think that the Jewish population is going down because the Yetzer is going down. Instead, it's the opposite.
It's going different direction.
The opposite.
Yes, today we have a different set of issues.
Correct. It's weird. Now we have the idea that the Yetzer is there just for pleasure. And therefore, procreation is something you might do and you might plan
optional.
To do, but it's essentially an optional part of the human condition. That was not the concept, either in the beginning, surely not in this book. The both are there. Pleasure is there, but pleasure is there. The assumption that procreation is there as well. They're both an essential piece of the picture.
But the whole system of Tarat Mishpacha is set up so that it would maximize the likelihood of procreation. I mean, it's not that you're just forbidden to your wife for that, you know, one day or two or 3 days, where it's an extended period, which roughly then will coincide with the time of the month that she's fertile. So the whole concept is, I mean, it pays attention to these inclinations, because the concept is the husband would be, first of all, it's a mitzvah, so if he's inclined to do what's right.
And if he hasn't had sex for 2 weeks.
And that's the other part. That's
correct. So it's both pleasureful and procreational. It's exactly both at the same time. It's pleasurable and procreational. chance.
In fact, I had it explained to me when I was in high school by the rabbi was to teach the boys in their last year the laws of Torah Samishpacha, and he gave a more modern justification for these laws, and it was, you know, the time of the sexual revolution, and he argued to us that the Torah was well ahead of its time, and that this was done so that Jews should not look at their wives, men should not look at their wives as sexual objects. They should have more, relationships should be about more, and that's why there were periods of the month where sex is just out of bounds, and that the Torah really, now in the 20th century, we're finally catching up to what the Torah understood all along.
Very good. Barry, what you read about the lack of lack of Jewish population, where was that?
I get this daily alert from the presidents of major Jewish organizations.
Ah, so that's along the lines of what I read,
0.35 to 0.26% of the world population.
Correct.
Something like that.
That's compared with, I think, the 1970 something or other.
Right.
It went down from about 0.35 to about 0.26, something like that. But the Jews as a proportion, of the world population is a diminishing piece of the world's population.
And now there are more diminishing Jews in Israel than in the United States.
Yeah, that was a very interesting tipping point, that the Jews, there are more Jews in Israel now than in the U.S. And the next tipping point, which is expected to be in about 2020, is that the majority of the world's Jewish population will live in Israel. That is the world Jewish population will live in Israel. Because realize you have two major communities and now Israel and the United States. Still a fair number in Russia. You have Argentina, France, North Africa, not so much North Africa, but France, some in England. But you do, at a certain point, in about 2020, this was a fellow at the Hebrew University, Pergo Lesa, who is the head of Jewish population studies at the Hebrew University, pointed to this, that in 2020, the majority of the world Jewish population will be in Israel. Now it's just compared to the United States. That has certain tremendous halachic ramifications. Tremendous halachic ramifications will come at that point, because there are many laws that today are considered the Rabbanan, rabbinic, which will then become from the Torah. And they will become laws of the Torah once the majority of the world's Jewish population lives in Israel. And that's not the case today. For example, the law of Shemitah. Rav Kook was able to create a law of the sabbatical year and enable the farmers in Israel to sell their land to an Arab. It's called the Heter Mechira. He was able to do that for the sabbatical year. He was able to do that because the law of the sabbatical year today is the Rabbanan. It's a rabbinic law. Once it becomes the Oraita, that will change. That will change. And it's in the process now already of changing. If you remember the last sabbatical year, the Jerusalem Rabbinate did not accept it, didn't accept the Heter Mechira. And it's a number of things like that, the Trumot, Masrot, the tithes, all those laws, the challah, the taking of challah from a bread, is done now de Rabbanan. It's a rabbinic law. At that point, it will become de Oraita, and the nature of the law changes, and the way in which it's observed will change. But that's about 2020.
What's the connection between the majority of the world's population being Israel and the transition of the source?
Because the Torah says, Ki tavo'u el ha'aretz. And the question is, what's the meaning of Ki tavo'u? Does it mean that all of you will come? And throughout the halachic literature, no, when you will come.
When
you will come. Ki is when. So the question not that, but what is you? What's the tavo? And nearly all the commentators say that it's the majority. Rubo kechulo is the halachic principle. When the majority comes, it's as if everybody comes.
Yeah.
So a majority is what makes the halachic difference. So that's the issue.
When I was in Israel, I remember...
Wait.
Oh, sorry. Did you recognize me?
All right. When I was in Israel, I heard a discussion, an argument on television, and one rabbi was saying it was all right when Israel was a poor country to not to observe Shemitah, but now that Israel is among the wealthy countries of the world, they should go back to Shemitah.
You tell that to the farmers in the kibbutzim.
Yeah.
Okay.
But these
Nancy?
Are based on affiliated Jews, right?
No, it's not. It's not. Oh. It's based on all of these population studies are done not on affiliated Jews. There are these mystical crystal balls.
Yeah.
I've been for many years. The source of Jewish population has been the American Jewish Yearbook. So I was a student of the late Rabbi Wolf Kelman. So the Jewish American Jewish Yearbook would come out, and Rabbi Kelman would teach us. He would go over the different things that are in the American Jewish Yearbook, and would always concentrate on Jewish population. So he said, well, how do you think we know how many Jews there are? So that's a good question. How do we know how many Jews there are? You know, who's the demographic whiz that really has figured this thing out? He says, I'll tell you a secret. I said, what? He says, my sister. I said, what do you mean your sister? She writes the articles. And we talk about it at home, and she says, I think it's probably 7 million. So you got to keep this in mind. A lot of these things which we take as scientific fact, you know, they're all based on somebody's surmises around the dinner table, which happened already. I was his student at a number of years ago. I graduated in 71, so this is 35 years ago. So you're talking 35, 40 years ago, she was writing this. And of course, the statisticians afterwards, what do? They say, well, based on the, you know, in 1970s, you just heard it, 1970s, right? Based on the comparison between 1970 and now, 1970s, based on what his sister learned at the dinner table. You know, that's how they did these things. That was the sophistication. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, to be continued.
Thank you.
Thank you.